Winter.
Hello and welcome to What We Do in the Winter. This is the 77th episode in this series of podcasts from the Isles of Mull, Iona, Ulva, Gomatra, Erid, and Little Colonsay. I'm Alistair Satchell, I live outside of Dervig in the north of Mull, and I'll be your host today. Hello to you. Hope this finds you happy and well, wherever and whenever you happen to be. This episode is a conversation with Gail Struthers. Gail hails from the Hillfoots, the villages and towns around the foot of the Ochil Hills near Stirling. She's lived on Mull for many years now, and has worked principally in catering and hotels and cafes in the north of the island. She currently works at Bowman Court and our local hospital in Craigenure, where her cooking is very, very much appreciated. Our conversation takes us through Gail's childhood, her working life and travels away from the island, her life here on Mull, including her time running the Glengorham Cafe, where I first met her, and then into her passion for reading. Gail is one of my favourite people, so it was lovely to spend time with her for this episode, which I've been meaning to get around to for years. I'll be back at the end with a spot more. Now, it is with the greatest of pleasure that I hand you over to my friend, Gail Struthers. Who are you?
Well, my name is Gail Struthers, and I've lived on Mull now for about 30 years, which still doesn't seem believable somehow, but there we are, the time has gone. And I came here to originally work a season at Calgary Hotel, when it was still a hotel. I was a chef there for 6 seasons, and I think the first 2 winters I left again and went and worked on the mainland, and then I just gave up and gave into it, and I've lived full-time on the island ever since.
It got you.
It did, yes, very much so.
And where was home originally? Where do you come from originally?
Originally I'm from down sort of Stirling area, the Hillfoots, and just outside Stirling. So that's where I grew up. Lived in Dollar originally, and then moved to Bonnybridge, 2 very different places, I have to say.
Indeed, yeah.
So it was a bit of a learning curve when we moved to Bonnybridge. I was there for quite a while, and then we moved to, it was my grandparents' house just outside Stirling, it's called The Croft. It's not a croft as you would know it here, just a small holding, which was my dad's dream. And I was there a few years before I, left home and moved on with my own life. So, yeah.
What did your folks do in the Hillfoots?
My dad was a policeman.
Really?
So when we lived in Dollar, our house was actually the police station as well. It was a very high crime area. Mm. I can remember somebody coming to the door because they wanted to hand in a biro they'd found in the street. Not a fountain pen or anything fancy, just a biro. Mm-hmm. I went to first sort of couple of years at school there, and it was very nice, I think. But I don't know why we moved. I think my dad got a promotion or something. He ended up in Denny Police Station, and we went to Bonnybridge. So, yeah, it made things interesting at school, particularly in high school. You'd get people blaming you for their big brother getting arrested by your dad the night before, that kind of thing. It could be a little bit fraught at times, but for the most part, it was okay. I didn't love school, but I suppose I didn't hate it either. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you've got a brother as well?
Yeah, I've got a slightly older brother. He's about a year and a half older. Mm-hmm. So he's actually lives in my grandparents' house now.
The Croft?
Yeah, The Croft. So it's really nice when I go down to visit. I'm still going back to part of my childhood and something that's always been there in my life. I've visited my grandparents there when I was a kid. So,
what did they do? What was their kind of?
Well, I'm not exactly sure what my grandfather had done. He worked for, it was something to do with the War Department in stores and supplies, I think.
Quartermaster?
He wasn't in the army as such. Something along those lines. And my grandma, she was just at home sort of running the place, and there was I think, four of them. But, you know, it was a pretty tough life then. You know, I can remember my mum telling me that she was about six when my aunt was born. My granddad was away working at that time. Just after my aunt was born, a ton of coal got delivered, so my granny just got out of her bed and went and, you know, shoveled it into the into the shed. You just had to kind of get on with it, I suppose. And my grandma had been a maid in a big house when she was younger.
Right.
But that was, I think, a really hard life. She suffered terribly from arthritis later on. And they reckoned, you know, because they
were stooping and scrubbing and...
Well, and also as well, you know, they didn't have enough time to do their own laundry. So they were quite often having to put on
cold
uniforms that were still, you know, damp and cold. And yeah,
that's hellish.
Yeah, they got like half a day off a month sort of thing. It was pretty hardcore. She died when I was seven. But I have very fond memories of her. She was a very sweet lady. Scone cheeks and a penny, you know.
Lovely. Yeah. And your mum, what did she do?
She sort of stopped working when my brother and I came along. She went back to work, I think, when I was about eight or nine. And she worked part-time in the Bank of Scotland. Yeah, I mean, it was just a fairly average kind of childhood, I suppose. Nothing, we weren't rich, but we weren't poor either, you know. But we always had, you know, money for a wee holiday every year, you know. We'd go down to St Anne's or Scarborough, a week down there. Yeah, we always had that wee holiday every year and
Lovely.
Got out and about somewhere. But my dad hated going on holiday. He had a massive garden at the small building and Strover from his childhood. He was obsessed with growing strawberries on an industrial scale.
Really?
Yeah. Other fruit as well, but strawberries were the main thing. So that was our job as well. We were the child labour to pick all the fruit and do the tatties and turnips in October as well.
Aye, tatty hooking, yeah.
Yeah. So we went on strike one year because we realised we could go to the local nursery and get paid to pick the fruit. So we went on strike. He wasn't very happy about it, but I think my mum backed us up and he eventually paid us for doing it.
Well, that's the thing, going generations before, people would get paid on holiday for that. There'd be a tatty hooking holiday, wouldn't
there? Well, they did. In fact, that was, I think, one of the reasons there was that holiday at that time of the year, you know, and it was a big agricultural community around there then, and the farmers needed the kids home to help them out at that time.
What did it mean from having lived in towns to then move to the Croft? What was that like?
Well, I mean, Dollar wasn't particularly built up.
No, the Ochils are just there.
Yeah. And the bit of Bonnybridge we lived in was actually on the outskirts in a wee cul-de-sac.
Right.
So it never really felt like we'd kind of lived in a town proper as such. And moving out, well, I think we moved out to the Croft when I was about 15. So, you know, you were a bit like, oh, it's not going to be very easy to see friends or go out and what have you.
Did you have a moped?
No, I didn't, no. But after my mum and dad weren't too bad about giving us lifts, and my brother sort of passed his driving test as well, so he would occasionally help you out, you know, but I think we were a bit too close in age to... Yeah. We fought a lot, you know, we were like cat and dog. it wasn't terrible, but I wouldn't want to go back and live down there now. You know, all the places that were little hamlets and villages, individual personalities when I was growing up around there, they've all just kind of joined up now into this huge urban sprawl. And I hear this talk of building a big planned community now between Falkirk and Stirling. And I just think at some point, probably in the next 20, 30 years, you know, there's really not going to be very much to distinguish all these places.
Stirlkirk.
Well, yeah, I'll just Falkirk, yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, it's just going to be this massive sort of sprawl of houses. Yeah. So, I quite enjoy just being out in the wilds a wee bit.
It's always interesting to think about the languages and the dialects when places where we grew up. I was very conscious growing up in Dunoon how people in Greenock and Gourock spoke was different to us, and we knew they were different because they had different Scots. How conscious were you of a Scots language when you were growing up in around
Ireland? Probably not a huge deal. I do know that when we lived in Dollar, we were quite well spoken.
Right.
Not quite Edinburgh, Panlofy, but probably not too far off it.
Yeah.
And then we moved to Bonnybrigg, where the accent's really quite, you know, I don't mean this in an offensive way, but it's quite a coarse accent.
Yeah.
You've got elements of that real Glasgow in it. And, you know, I've got an aunt in that, you know, talks in a very broad accent. Yeah. And it's all, aye, we're just going Ben the Hoose to get the bairn and all this sort of thing, you know. But, of course, we realised very quickly if we spoke as we had done, we were just going to get beaten up at school.
Yeah.
So we sort of affected a more local accent when we were among our friends. But it could be a bit tricky if you were taking friends home. Your mum would be like, what are you speaking like that for? Speak properly.
Yeah.
But, that I suppose that was the first time I became aware of different accents. But then when we did Burns at school, I really enjoyed that. And I quite enjoyed, you know, learning that kind of old Scots. I still quite like a bit of Burns. Yeah, it's there's something quite special about it.
He's,
I think,
so playful with his language.
Mm.
My favourite one is "A Man's a Man for All That."
Oh yeah,
and the way that he just plays with the language so strongly in there, and even in like Tia Haggis, he's using very high register English, then back to Scots, and then to other things as well. There's the different registers of speech. He's just, he was playing with language and having fun.
I mean, I can still sit and read Tam O'Shanter now, and I'm just, blown away by it. It's a story.
The characters are amazing.
You know, when Chapman Billies leave the street and Ruthie Neighbours meet, you can just, you know, I'm quite a big Burns fan. I enjoy that. But then coming up here, I was quite surprised in a way. It's just not such a thing up here at all. But then you have the more of the Gaelic heritage up here, I suppose, which was something we didn't have at all growing up.
But there's also a lot more English folk here as well.
Well, there's that too, yeah.
I mean, I've tried to breed them out, but I've not. But, you know, it's one of these things, one at a time.
I mean, I always feel with the English thing and all, I think, well, I'm an incomer myself.
Yeah, totally.
So you can't really criticise someone else
nonsense.
Too much. I'd say there's maybe a certain type of person that comes here that we could probably do without. But for the most part, I think
people are people.
That's it. You just,
wherever you go, you take your arsehole with you.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't think of myself as having a particularly strong accent, but then when I hear myself, if I've recorded something, I'm already dreading having to listen to this because I'm just,
obligation.
I don't sound like that, do I?
No obligation, don't worry. It's when I put it through we're making the transcripts of these and put them through the spell checker or the transcription service. It's insane. It picks up on all sorts of things and tries to make it into what people are concerned about in the moment because it's anticipating.
Yeah.
And so you end up with stuff about Palestine and you're like, what? What are we talking about? You know, Grieben. Not Gaza. So what would you do for fun in the later part of your teenage years? If you were going to go to the cinema, would you head into Stirling? Where would you head into? Would you head into Edinburgh? Where would you go?
No, I didn't go into Edinburgh and Glasgow so much. It would be Falkirk, actually, for the cinema.
Right.
They had quite a good wee cinema there, and there was lots of nice wee restaurants and bars as I got slightly older around there, so we'd go and make a night of it in Falkirk. And there was, I always remember there'd been some quite good little clubs and stuff as well. One or two of them, which I believe are still around.
Well.
Yeah, so we'd get dolled up in ridiculous 80s fashions and head out to the, whatever the latest trend was in clubs and, I mean, they're pretty basic now compared to the likes of what you get in the bigger, particularly bigger places. But yeah, we had a lot of fun there. You know, it was getting drunk on Malibu and pineapple and
God!
I know.
I've got a hangover already just thinking about it.
Dry martinis as well. That was a big favourite, yeah.
Car wash.
Yeah, horrendous. But, you know, when you're that age, you'll literally try anything, won't you? So, yeah, I did probably overdo the alcohol a bit in my earlier years, but it's not something that's stayed with me. I don't really drink very often now at all. It's, I don't think I like that feeling of being out of control as I get older, you know. So, yeah.
I hear you. Your career then, you left school at 17?
Yeah, yeah.
What did you do after that?
I initially went to Falkirk Tech to do a course in hotel management. As part of that, I had to go and work in an appropriate career for the summer. And I ended up in Callander, in probably the worst hotel in Callander, actually.
Oh,
it was pretty, you know, it was coach parties.
Yeah.
We still did high tea then. You know, get a sort of, I can still remember, it was ham salad, sausage, egg and chips or fish and chips. But it was the frozen haddock with the bright orange.
Ruscoline.
Yeah. And if they were coming in at 4 o'clock, we'd start, there'd be like 60 of them, would start cooking it at 2:30 and stack it up with plate rings in the hot cupboard. I mean, it was just horrendous. But it was my first job away from, you know, and living away from home. I was just living at large. That's where I discovered Indian food and Chinese food.
Yeah.
I suppose bar life as well, because there was 36 pubs in Callander then. Yeah, I had the most pub. I had the most pubs per capita in Scotland at that time.
It's insane.
Yeah, and I was in every single one of them, believe me. Yeah, I was in staff accommodation and it was absolutely Victorian, you know. The staff food was horrendous. Like, there's your tea and it'd be a boiled egg and you'd be like, what?
Oh, that's terrible.
Oh, you can have some chips if you want. You're like, oh, great. Mouldy pies. And so as a result of that, we just basically stole lots of food. if they just fed us properly in the first place, it would have been a lot cheaper, you know. Yeah, I mean, it kind of opened up my eyes to life a bit. And just, I wasn't actually that far from home. It was only about 15 miles away, but not having that parental kind of hovering over you thing. And I probably went a bit overboard, to be honest, but it was good fun.
Yeah. That's what you'd swore. Yeah, totally. At what point did you start into catering and cooking for yourself?
Well, I actually started cooking quite young. My mum always cooked, you know, there was never any bought-in food. And I don't think there was really anything like that about then.
Findus crispy pancakes?
Yes, I vaguely remember them, but that was something you had at other people's houses. It
Bird's wasn't, eye potato waffles and so
wasn't
on.
It wasn't something we ever got, you know. We had chips, I think, maybe once a week, and they were just cooked in a pan with beef dripping.
Yep.
You still smell it. Oh.
Yeah.
And my mum was quite a good cook, quite plain. I mean, spices didn't really play a part, but it was all good. She made potted hock and meatloaf, and we made all our own jam from the endless supply of fruit that my dad grew, chutneys. And so I grew up around that.
Lovely.
And I think my mum started working afternoons when I was about 11 or 12. And I just kind of started getting the dinner on.
Yeah.
So I always had that sort of cooking thing there. I hadn't sort of thought about it as a career. But after doing a year in Callander, I actually went to Edinburgh to continue on with the hotel management. But I'm not particularly academic. I'm interested in things and I want to find out as much as I can about them.
Yes.
If I'm not interested, I'm going to put zero effort into it. The following year, when I had to go and do my work experience, I ended up in the Craigan Hotel at Loch Awside.
Oh, yeah.
And that was my first sort of venture up into this part of the world.
Right.
I failed one of the parts of the course. And I thought, well, while I was at the Craigan, I was just there really, you know, I'd help out with stuff in the kitchen. But the woman who did dinners, she unfortunately took ill, and they just sort of said, okay, you can do that now. And I was sort of like, can I? And but I look back now, I mean, some of it was pretty cringy, and but it was the early 80s. People were very easily pleased, you know. And that's, I thought, yeah, I quite like this cooking thing. So I didn't go back to college and stuck with the cooking, yeah.
And was it Tyn Alt that you chose as home, or was it?
Yeah, well, I did 8 seasons at Tyn Craigan Hotel. My life gets quite confusing because I've mainly worked seasonally.
Yes, yeah, of course.
So it gets quite difficult sometimes to work out what year's what.
Yeah, where did you go off seasons then? Were you?
Well, at that time, I would go abroad and work in the winter, but not cooking. I used to go and do farm work. So I milked cows in Israel. I was on a kibbutz in Israel.
Goodness me, how was that? Being non-Jewish as well, was that very...
Oh, no, that wasn't an issue. I mean, it's like saying Britain is a Christian country.
Yeah, yeah.
Most people aren't practicing Christians. Yeah, yeah. And it's really the... But what my experience then was, it was the same in Israel. It's a Jewish country, but most people weren't observant.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
We would make pals with some of the younger kibbutzniks and... Can you get us any bacon? And they'd be like, oh, yeah, no bother, you know, and we'd get stuff like that. But we basically lived in I went with a friend that I'd worked at the hotel with, and we basically lived in a garden shed with a sink outside on a wee porch. The toilet was about a 5-minute walk away. So we'll just say the grass in front of the hut was well watered.
Very green, very green.
And we had a grapefruit tree right outside.
Wow.
And the arak, which is the local booze, it's like ouzo, was 20 pence a bottle from the kibbutz shop.
Hello.
So Sabbath was a Saturday, so Friday night was party night, ridiculous amounts of arak, and we'd just squeeze out the grapefruit, so it was arak and grapefruit juice.
Wow.
We had a wee volunteer's pub, you got 0.5 litres of beer for, oh God, something like, yeah, probably 20 pence as well. We'd have a few of those, and then it was disco in the bomb shelter. I went there sober once, and I've never been so terrified in my life, because it was like 8 flights of stairs in the pitch black. And I'm like, how did I do this? Oh, I was drunk, that's how I did it.
Come on, this way!
Yeah, there was like 3 disco lights.
Yeah.
There was these weird little alcoves round the walls of the place with pits in them. There's no other word for it. There were holes in the ground.
Yeah.
I'm assuming at some point it was some kind of drainage. So occasionally people would disappear into those and have to be hauled out. And we'd be there till like 5-6 in the morning. And then we'd get up on the Saturday and walk about 2 miles up to the local petrol station that had a wee cafe and get chicken schnitzel or falafel.
Oh, lovely. Nice.
And Fanta, ice cold Fanta. Fanta doesn't taste the same here. But on the way up there, we're passing all these like citrus fields, so you'd like grab an orange or a grapefruit right off the tree, and it was good hangover stuff.
It's perfect, yeah.
And then also I was in New Zealand one winter doing something similar.
Like that? Yeah, what was New Zealand like?
I enjoyed it actually, but it did seem a wee bit archaic.
Really?
You know, I was out in the country because I was doing farming. But, you know, when you wanted to phone someone, it still went through an exchange and you had to tell someone the number.
Yeah.
But it's the only place I got homesick, I think, because it was just...
Very far away.
And this is all before mobile phones, computers. I think I made one phone call home the whole time I was there, you know.
Yeah.
So the homesickness didn't last for long. I had a day or two where I felt a bit weepy, and then I was fine again. And then I was in Denmark one winter as well.
Love Denmark.
Yeah.
Whereabouts were you, in South?
I was in the middle, just outside Svendborg.
Okay.
So I had friends there anyway when I'd worked at Tyn Craigan, and one of the owners was Danish. So she had Danish people coming over to work there. So I had some contacts there and friends. And yeah, it was good fun. But
Danish folk, I have to say,
milking cows in the winter. And I mean, I think the climate there is normally a bit like ours, but they had an exceptionally cold winter, and the whole farmyard was just like a skating rink. Trying to get across to in between the different sheds was a bit of a nightmare. There was one morning in particular, the actual milk was freezing in the pipes, as it was coming out, and milk coming out of cow is ridiculously, really it's really quite hot.
Yeah.
But it would get so far along the pipe, and then the pipe would just freeze up.
Back up.
17 hours to milk the cows that day. It was just horrendous. But it's character building, you know.
Yeah.
And there was always lots of schnapps and gammeldansk to warm you up.
What's gammeldansk? I don't know that.
It's a bitters. It's, I suppose, a little bit like the Danish version of Benedictine, something like that.
Becherovka kind of still thing.
Sort of thing. It's quite hard work, but, you know, first thing in the morning, if you've been out the night before, it definitely perks you up if you can keep it down. that was good. And then one year I just went sort of into railing and wandered about for a while. I got to see a little bit of the world. And
quite a lot of the world, yeah.
Yeah, it's quite nice just to... I think when you're living in a place for a while and interacting with everyday people, not
reality.
Just being in the tourist spots, it's quite nice. Yeah.
Tinalt then. How did you come to settle there? And when, because you had, did you have the food van in Tinalt at one point?
No, I had the, there was a wee tea shop beside the caravan park at Bridge of Awe. And I did that for, I think, about 3 years.
Was that your own business venture?
Well, I started with a friend, but you know what they say, you shouldn't go into business with friends. I never got into the big fight kind of thing. It was more, ended in a bit of disappointment, I would say, in a way, a wee bit of hurt maybe. And when that all ended, that was when I came to Mull for the first time, yeah.
So how did you hear about Mull? How did you hear about Calgary, rather?
I think I must have seen an advert somewhere. And I came over for the interview. Matthew picked me up at the boat and off we went. And I just thought, well, this is quite a nice place, you know.
Mm.
So, yeah, I ended up there and I was at Calgary for, I think, 6 seasons. Really enjoyed it.
What sort of things were you cooking at Calgary?
It was, I did breakfast and dinner.
Mm-hmm.
When I think back on it now, the weird thing is we didn't really use huge amounts of local produce. It's not the same as it is now.
Right.
I don't think we were as sort of switched on to it. Sometimes there'd be a bit of beef from someone or a bit of pork from someone else. I think while I was there, they just started doing pigs at Scabrua, so we sometimes got a bit of pork from them. But I think for the most part, we bought in stuff like that.
What about Elmo cheese, which we
used? Well, obviously, with Matthew's involvement, we always had the cheese, and they actually still did cream and milk at that time as well. But, but that was about it, really, yeah. We got veg brought in, but there just wasn't the same
mentality,
thought about it then, I suppose. And we were just doing sort of quite a bit of fish, and obviously we used prawns and scallops and local shellfish.
Doogie, and all that.
Yeah, and then fish from Malig. I liked working there. I made some really good friends there that I still have today, like Sony Bo. And
was Sony working with you there?
Yeah, we worked together. Yeah, it was just, we used to get to deal with the sort of stress and or boredom, because catering is like that. You're either twiddling your thumbs or you're having an absolute meltdown. And Howard Pittman was working there as well. Al Morrison worked there as well for a while. And Anna Gleason and all sorts of people. So we used to just make up all these, I'm not going to tell you any of them, but we used to make up all these backstories for local people and give them characteristics. It was nothing to do with the people they actually were, but would do their voices, and it made us laugh and it passed the time, you know.
Without naming anyone, can you tell us one that sticks out in your mind at all?
If I say anything, I'll probably give too much away. I mean, there was nothing really nasty about any of it, but... I think we'll probably just skate over that. It was just a bit of fun to pass the time. Yeah. If you ever do any bow, she'll tell you.
She's on the list.
Yeah.
Yeah. From what you're saying there about Calgary, camaraderie seems to be one of the main things about it.
It was. Well, I mean, we We partied quite a bit. Yeah, we'd be out and about at the weekends. And I mean, I was in my sort of mid-30s, really, by then. I should have been old enough to know better, but I wasn't. So there we go. Yeah, no, we had a lot of fun there, actually, yeah. But after 6 seasons, I sort of felt wanted to try something else. So I went up to the Bellacroix.
How was that?
Yeah, well, it was different, obviously. Yeah. Yeah, it was quite hectic, you know, when you're dealing with something like the rally or the music festival. It was, yeah. It's just, but really it's just about being organised, you know, doing your prep, making sure you're just ready for action, putting your head down and, you know, getting through it. That's all you can do, really. But I quite liked being at the pub. It was nice. Weirdly enough, though, once I started working there, I didn't go in to socialise as much.
Yes.
It was that sort of...
Yeah, work.
I had to kind of take a step back from it almost. Yeah, I quite enjoyed it.
Where were you staying when you were working at the pub?
It was where Em's house is now, opposite the pub.
Oh, yeah.
There was a caravan there.
Right.
I lived in there. And then the pub changed hands and I just...
Was it Andrew Arnold when you were there first?
Or? No, it was Nick and Louise.
Okay.
Yeah, they weren't really there for that long. Yeah, when it changed hands, I just thought, nah. It was actually Pat and Julie Bewley. So I said, oh, Peter Potter's looking for a cook for up at... Well, it's the Hebridean Lodge now, but yes. It was the Pottery then. And I thought, okay. And they'd just been doing lunches up there. And I said to him, well, you know, I'd like to come and work for you. Because it was a nice space up there, that mezzanine floor.
Yeah, lovely.
Nice wee kitchen. And I said, we could maybe give dinners a go. And he was like, yeah, why not? So I had I think I was there 4 years. And it just got a bit, I was doing split shifts and still living in Dervig.
Oh,
and,
God, you'd be knackered.
Yeah, it was, and at some point during that, my thyroid packed in and I didn't realise it for ages. I just couldn't understand why I was falling asleep all the time. But we got that sorted out. God. It was fine. But yeah, eventually I just got to the stage. I thought, God, there's got to be something a wee bit easier. I love doing it, you know. But and I got on great with Pete. I really liked working for him. But it was just, the split shifts and everything were just getting a bit much. And Julie Patton, once again, was sort of like, oh, you end up looking for somebody at Glengorm. So I went up and spoke to Tom and Marjorie, and I think that must be 16 years ago, and I've been there ever since. Yeah. So...
Well, and you just recently, in the last year, finished your own kitchen there now and moved on elsewhere.
I worked for Tom and Marjorie for, must have been about 8 years, 8 seasons. And then they offered me the chance to, you know, rent the business from them and run it as my own. I thought, well, why not? What else am I going to do? I like the place.
Yeah.
I'm living here. Yeah, I did that for, I think that must be 8 seasons, or is it 9? Creeping up to 60 now, and last season I really found it was a wee bit more of a struggle, but thoroughly enjoyed it.
How many covers a day would you be doing peak season?
Well, peak season you could be doing anything between sort of 60 and 90, and you've got...
Oh. No, thank you.
Yeah,
it's huge.
You're kind of doing that on your own, but you just, as I say, it's all about being organised. Yeah. But there were some days in there, I have to be honest, we went over the 100, and I remember one day just going in, there was a wee store cupboard just at the back of the kitchen, because it's not a big kitchen, it's just a wee galley. And I actually thought I was going to start crying. I just had to really take a few deep breaths. Yeah, I was like, I can't go back out there. And you just wanted to kind of run away, but we always got there in the end. And for the most part, people can see how busy you are and they're patient and understanding. Totally. But I suppose another thing that's changed in the last few years is, you know, unfortunately, people's sense of entitlement as to...
Yes.
And, you know, you'd get... It only takes one arsehole, you know.
Yeah.
Everybody else that day can be lovely.
Yeah.
But it's the arsehole you always remember that nags away at you and takes the joy out of it for you. It was I thoroughly enjoyed doing it. I just like feeding people. It feeds me in a way if that's not too weird.
No, not at all.
I'm not always very good in when people are going through a tough time or bad things are happening, at necessarily having the right words or being able to say the right words. But if I can make them something to eat, that's just my way of saying...
There's so much more.
Yeah, you know.
It does.
I'm not sure how I can really help you here, but
yeah.
Here's something for your tea tonight or a wee cake to have with your cup of tea or something. Yeah. And that's, I suppose that's how I show people I care in a way. Yeah, I just love doing that. And now I'm down at the hospital cooking in Bowman's Court. And initially, because it's not as hectic as full on, I wasn't too sure about it. But I'm finding my feet there now and I'm quite enjoying it, you know, and knowing that you've... Because, you know, you're feeding old people who quite often don't have a lot going on in their life.
Yes.
And their meal times are sort of a highlight in a way. And if you know you've made them something nice, a wee, nice wee bit of pudding afterwards, and that's cheered them up a bit, it's just nice, you know. And I'm really quite enjoying it. The people that are working down there are all seem to be very nice.
That's
and
great.
Nice environment to work in.
In the time that you've been working in catering, you'll have seen food movements come and go change. What for you has been the most successful of the style of food and philosophy of food you've engaged with in your career, would you say?
Well, when I first started cooking, I think Nouvelle Cuisine was at its height.
Oh, yeah.
And people slag it off. A bit of chicken and a slice of kiwi fruit, you know.
Yeah.
But to my way of thinking, that was necessary. We were so bogged down in this French classic, you know.
Yeah.
Except in most places, they weren't even doing it properly. You know,
yeah.
They were buying in the sauce mixes and drowning everything in cream. And there's nothing wrong with cream.
And you're a speak-up problem.
I'll always defend the use of cream and butter in food. But, you know, it just ended up that there was an awful lot of bad food being served in an awful lot of places that wasn't authentically French. It was just a bad version of it. And Nouvelle Cuisine, I think, just kind of swept a lot of that away.
Yeah.
And then you had the likes of Gary Rhodes coming in and saying, actually, we do have pretty good food here in Britain.
Yep.
And he's saying, well, why are we? You know, there's nothing wrong with French food.
Yeah.
But we do have actually some great dishes in our own country that we can be very proud of. And he sort of revised them and modernised them a bit. They were still very recognisably those traditional British foods, but they were, you know, sort of perked up a little bit for modern palates. And I think that's, you know, something that's kept pushing through in food. And I've never been one to follow trends, you know. One of the things I've enjoyed, because we've mentioned it already, is seeing local produce being used. I think that's a great thing. I'm not always such a fan of the, you know, you see these chefs insisting that they go out with baskets every morning to forage for their dinner that night. And I think, what kitchen are you working in? Because nobody's got time for that. And I do think it's probably also led to a lot of destruction of things because people don't know how to forage.
Yes.
You don't just pull the whole thing out. You know, you have to, and I mean, I'm not an expert myself.
Yeah.
I wouldn't pretend to be. But I think there's a fine line there where you can definitely be using, you know, what's being produced locally without going as far as the sort of Scandi cuisine goes where they say, oh no, we can't have lemon because they don't grow here. But we've got this herb that grows on a hillside that tastes slightly of citrus. You're just like, no, put some lemon on it, mate.
Yes. That'll sort you out.
It's not the end of the world if you buy a lemon, you know.
One foraging workshop here where there was someone who decided they were going to be doing these kind of workshops, and I don't think that I can say this without identifying them, but they were certainly had a guidebook with them to tell them, you know, what to do, and they hadn't really done very much, and it was like, it's just fadism.
Well, yeah, there's I can't be doing with these fads.
What would you say that the highlights of local produce are around here? What for you have been the nicest things to cook and eat?
Well, I mean, I think one of my top ones would definitely be langoustine.
Really?
Oh, the langoustine. Just love langoustine, yeah. I mean, a squat lobster's nice. I do like them as well. Lobster, you know.
Yeah, Georgia feels the same as well. Yeah, I'm not much of a seafood person.
But a really good langoustine, just fresh as, and I mean, it's sweet, and if you cook it properly, you know, it's just, yeah, it's one of the best things. I also, I'm very partial to plugging the home brand here a bit, but I don't think you can beat a bit of Glengarn beef. I mean, it's got a real, you know, depth of flavour to it. You do notice the difference with the Highland cows because they take so long to mature.
Yeah.
They're not just, you know, knocking them on the head at a year or two years old. You know, they've got to really, you know, go some to grow up. And you definitely taste that in the finished product.
That's
beautiful. It's fantastic beef. I'm just trying to think what else actually there is.
Oney's pork, I'm very
fond of. Oh yeah, Oney's pork. How could I forget that? I just had chops the other night for tea and damn fine.
Local pork, fresh local pork. We don't have bacon very often, but when you do and you see the marbling in it and the fat, it's like, holy goodness.
For me, pork is all about the fat. The indigestion afterwards is always worth it.
It's definitely worth it, yeah.
Bit of belly pork. Oh, yeah, delicious.
What do you think then that Mull means to you, because you've got your brother and you've got your brother's family and now his children's children as well.
Yeah.
Back in the sort of central belt. What do you think Mull means to you?
I think it just means home now, really. I can't really think of anywhere else I would rather live. Maybe in some respects, I'm just at a stage where I don't really want to go and start off somewhere new. Driving to work in the morning, and there's something there all the time to look at. There's always a new... Yeah, I think home would really sum it up. This is where I feel at home. I enjoy going away. I quite like going to the big city and having all the amenities and all the rest of it for a few days. But when I'm driving back up the road, there's almost a sense of relief, you know.
Yeah.
Get on the boat and you can...
The airlock.
Oh, yeah, that's it. We're nearly home now, you know. Yeah, I think that sums it up for me.
There's one more thing I was going to ask. Reading, obviously, a lot of our connections are around kind of all the amount of stuff, because you've read so much across so many styles. What do you find that reading means to you?
Sometimes it's about knowledge. I like to know stuff. Yeah. As I said, I think earlier, if I'm interested in something, I'll, you know, go all out to find out about it. And it's weird stuff that I think maybe particularly women don't always think about. I'm absolutely fascinated by 20th century history.
Yeah.
The First and Second World War.
Weimar Republic and all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Korean War as well. I did as well, but I've been finding out a lot more about it recently. Absolutely horrific.
Yeah.
Do you know they dropped more bombs on Laos? This is more Vietnam related actually, but they dropped, well, at that time in North Korea, the American Air Force dropped more bombs on North Korea than they had in the whole of the Second World War on Germany.
That's horrendous.
And I mean, you know, it was just such a brutal conflict.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are like, well, why do you want to know about stuff like that? That's not nice. But
I think it's part of us,
it's part of who we are as human beings. What would push you to do some of the things that people have had to do in these situations?
Yeah.
I'm fascinated by Stalingrad.
Oh, God, it's terrifying.
And I read it, actually, it's a non-fiction book. I can't remember the author.
Anthony Beaver?
No, I've read that one. Yeah, this is Yeah, sorry, this is fiction, I should say. But it's, I think, one of the best books I've ever read about what it feels like to be hungry. Like, really hungry. And the extremes that you'll go to feed not just yourself, but particularly if you have children. Because you're watching your kids starve to death.
Jesus.
And, you know, at the end of the siege of Stalingrad, there was no pets left. There was no zoo animals.
No.
People resorted to cannibalism.
Yeah.
And I know it's a pretty gruesome subject, but I find that just fascinating. How do people...
Yeah.
It's not so much about... I like to know the historical facts, but I'm not overly fussed about knowing the exact date things, but it's about how people coped in these situations. I'm fascinated by that.
As a caterer, that's a quite a scary question.
Would I be the Sweeney Todd the occult apocalypse?
Exactly that. Gail's pies are amazing. No wonder the sausage rolls were so addictive.
Well, all the tattoos people have got now, I'm not sure you'd get away with it the same.
Yeah, Stalingrad is... It's, and there's still bodies outside, apparently.
Oh, God, yeah.
No, and,
I mean, but then you think all of that happened, plus, you know, the Holocaust and... The Blitz and the destruction of Europe. One of the best books I've read about the war was actually the immediate aftermath of it. Because you think, oh yeah, the war finished in 1945, May 1945, but there was still all sorts of stuff going on then. I mean, Poland is one of the most ethnically pure countries in the world because at the end of the Second World War, they booted out all the ethnic Germans and all the ethnic Ukrainians, and likewise in Ukraine they booted out all the ethnic Poles. And it was, we're talking about 200 million people here and in amongst, on the move in a place that was being absolutely devastated by war and all sorts of horrific things happening to, you know, these people. I mean, there's just so much stuff to learn and find out about it. I just find it fascinating.
In the world of fiction, are there any particular authors that you really just cherish?
Well, it's got to be Stephen King.
That was a leading question.
You knew that already.
Yeah, exactly,
but
definitely.
I just... And people go, ooh, horror.
So much more than
that. It's so much. And he's written so many books that aren't about horror. They're about people. And I think he actually writes women quite well.
Yeah.
Even... his earlier stuff.
Yeah, they're not just victims.
Oh, no. They're quite often the protagonists.
Carrie was the first book as well.
And I think about Dolores Claiborne, that's it. And there's no real horror in it. There's no supernatural stuff. It's basically about a mother and a daughter. And it's just perfect. It's, And then he did a book with his own son.
Yes.
Where men kind of get their comeuppance, really. And they're forced to look at themselves and the way that they behave. So, he's definitely my main man.
I know this is not the most popular of his books, but I really love Dr. Sleep.
Yeah, I quite liked that as well. My favourite, but I did quite like it.
As someone who's struggled with addiction over his own life, I just thought it was such a brilliant representation of kind of rock bottom and redemption.
Yeah.
I thought I really just empathised with the character so much. After all, the horror that he'd been through as a child.
Yeah.
Quite literally. And then this kind of path of redemption that he and eventually his father goes on. I was in tears. I thought it was brilliant. Yeah. So...
I mean, there are other authors I do like, but he's definitely the main one for me.
Thank you so much, Gail. I really, really appreciate your time on this. It was so good to hear your stories. I hope we catch up again very soon. Hearing Gail talk about her passion for feeding people and the connections that sharing food can bring to them is one of my favourite reflections I've yet heard on this project. If you've ever been fortunate enough to eat Gail's cooking, you'll know how deeply she feels this. Now, on another note, If you're listening and wanted to support the podcast, the easiest way to do so is to leave a rating or a review wherever you listen to the podcast. If you're a new listener and want to subscribe to the podcast, it would be lovely to have you with us. You'll be among thousands of listeners from all over the world. If you've listened to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, it's very easy to leave a review. You just scroll to the bottom of the page and leave a star rating, or if you wanted to say a few words in support of the project, that would be very much appreciated. If you wanted to, you could also support the podcast with a donation through PayPal or Ko-fi.com. Details on how to do this can be found on whatwedointhewinter.com on the Donate tab at the top of the page, and thank you for considering this. If you're not in a position to donate or don't want to, that's totally and utterly fine. I'd much rather that you came along with us on this journey rather than not. On that note, thank you very much to our recent supporters and monthly donors. I really, really appreciate your support. Thank you most kindly. Well, there you go. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Take care, wherever you are. Mórantáin, sin acadh.